After the British election results, a big piece of the European Union may not break off quite so fast. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Britain's ruling Conservative Party has lost its majority in the Parliament and will have to make nice to political partners to get work done. Work like pulling the UK out of the EU, with the unwinding process due to begin this very month. Let's switch to Brussels and bring in the BBC's Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly. Mr. Connolly, good morning.
Good morning.
I've studied a bit about the art of negotiation, and this election outcome in the UK doesn't seem the best way to enter a high-stakes negotiation like the one to extricate Britain from the EU. It seems like a weakened hand, doesn't it?
I think it does, and that's for a couple of reasons. One of them is a very practical reason. The UK effectively started a two-year clock running on its departure from the European Union back in March. That's very, very difficult to change. So holding this election after starting the clock is seen in Brussels as an act of political self-harm, if you like. And the other reason, it's much more to do with the whole issue of authority. I think Theresa May was assumed to be coming back to the Brexit negotiations with an enormously enhanced majority. Some of that magical quality of political authority is going to be seen to have gone from Theresa May whenever the Brexit talk starts.
And it's possible European negotiators might try to drive a harder bargain. What might be some of the concessions the EU is looking for?
I don't think the EU is going to frame this in terms of things it wants from the UK. The European Union view is that this is all about settling a few outstanding issues and then ultimately talking about the architecture of a new relationship. So it doesn't have a list of demands for Britain. The view in Brussels is, look, it's Britain that decided to leave the European Union. It's up to Britain to come up with some proposals, frankly. But if Theresa May had come back with a huge storming majority in the House of Commons at Westminster, she would be seen as a strengthened political figure with a mandate for what's called a hard Brexit that would place Britain outside the European single market, outside the free movement of labour, and outside the customs union. I think there might be a hope in Brussels now that a diminished Theresa May, someone without a parliamentary majority, might have to listen to voices elsewhere in the UK Parliament and even in her own party who want something of a softer Brexit. So they're not going to come up with new ideas or proposals here. They are, I think, hoping privately that they might be facing a rather chastened opponent on the other side of the negotiating table.
Kevin Connolly, BBC Europe correspondent, speaking from Brussels. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, David Brancaccio, stepping out of my anchorman role for a second. Marketplace is here because these days I think it's essential to have an independent source exploring how the economy really works, not just for the market participants or the financial geniuses, but for everyone. Your support keeps our kind of reporting coming, and it is especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. If you could, visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us on the beat. Thank you. While the subject somehow didn't come up at the Comey hearings yesterday, the White House had proclaimed this is the week to talk about $1 trillion in new infrastructure for America. The administration envisions some of that trillion will come from what are called public-private partnerships. I feel no shame in admitting that I don't fully understand these, so I want to consult Robert Puentes, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, a nonpartisan policy think tank. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
What is a P to the third power, a P3, a public-private partnership? Let me understand this better.
These public-private partnerships for infrastructure are alternatively framed as either a panacea to all of America's infrastructure challenges, or else it's a corporate takeover of critical public assets. The reality is that they're neither one of these things. This is a new tool that's being used increasingly in the U.S. for procuring or managing infrastructure, because of the ability for states and localities to borrow at very, very low rates. It's almost always going to be cheaper for them to do things in a traditional way, for them to borrow money or them to raise taxes or other kind of fees and do the projects themselves. With a private partner, you engage in these projects not to save money, but to do them in a better way, to get more value for money in those cases where that opportunity exists.
So how do you incentivize this so that investors get interested? I suppose if you placed a toll on a new bridge, you could share some of the toll money with the investor.
there would have to be some kind of way to pay the private sector firms here. They're not going to do it for any kind of altruistic reason or for any kind of public policy goal. They need to be paid somehow. They're not going to be interested in doing things like fixing the challenges with Washington subway system or with Amtrak or with the Flint water crisis. I mean, some of these things are really being designed because they are public policy goals and things that we need to do from a government standpoint. But there's other things like the toll bridge you mentioned where there actually might be private sector interest.
You mentioned the type of project that might not be suitable for a public-private partnership. A new water system for a city that's suffering through problems with lead in the old pipes, that wouldn't stand first in line for a public-private partnership. Why not?
I think water projects certainly could make themselves attractive to private firms. We actually saw this in New Jersey, Hoboken, Rialto, California has also done that. The challenge in a place like Flint is that it's tied up in a lot of politics. It's tied up in a lot of uncertainty. And the one thing that the private partners don't want is uncertainty that they can't control because they can't guarantee a positive return.
Robert Puentes is president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, which is a nonpartisan think tank. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And today, Japan's parliament passed a law that legalizes Airbnb, and really anyone there who wants to rent out their property for as long as 180 days a year. Local authorities still have the authority to license this, licenses that'll come with restrictions. Tokyo has the 2020 Olympic Games, and a lot of Japanese property owners are going to make a killing off this now. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.